Calling all benders and non-benders alike. Jump into the epic world of Avatar with your favorite podcast, Avatar Braving the Elements. Hosted by me, Janet Varney.
And me, Dante Bosco. Each week we'll recap and discuss a new episode.
So come join us and our amazing guests, from creators to cast to superfans, to chat about all things Avatarverse.
It's Fire Nation time. Book of Fire. Let's go. Listen to Avatar Braving the Elements
wherever you get your podcasts.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
I remain Justin.
I'm Pete.
And on The Stack, we talk about a bunch of comics that have come out this week. We review them, and we offer harsh and fair opinions. Let's be honest.
We're
don't
fair.
Promise
we are
any
fair.
Of that. Don't even
as
set
well as
us
well
up for
well reasoned
failure.
And well planned discussion.
Boo.
Where we delve into each book and we never make jokes.
Let's say we said fair and balanced before Fox News did, and now that they've abandoned it, we're taking it back. We're fair and balanced.
Well, let's see if we're fair and balanced about this first one. Titans Beast World, number 6 from DC Comics, written by Tom Taylor, art by Ivan Rice, Lucas Meyer, and Eduardo Pensica. We are finishing up the Beast World storyline. Beasts have no longer taken over the world. In fact, in this issue, the Titans fight back and change everybody back from beasts, but we have a bunch of different wars being fought on different fronts. We're, of course, going to get into spoilers for this issue as it changes absolutely everything for the DC Universe once again. Here we are getting Gar Logan is dead, but they bring him back to life. We are getting Dr. Hate, who is the evil Raven, is beaten. Or is she? It turns out that Dr. Hate takes over Raven, and Raven is trapped now. And Amanda Waller is beaten.
Twist.
Or is she? Because she changed the Hall of Justice into the Hall of Order. The opposite of justice. I'm sure some other things happened.
Man, oh, what you spoiled the shit out of this. And also, I don't like your attitude about this, all right? I don't like you making fun of comics while we're talking about a
could
comic.
You, when you tell me you don't like my attitude, could you please phrase it as Little Rabbit Foo-Foo, I don't like your attitude, because I would prefer that.
I don't know what you're talking
that's
about.
That's funny. We said Little Bunny Foo-Foo where I'm from. I wonder what the difference there is.
Yeah. It's regional difference.
Are you fancy and I'm not? Because we're like bunnies.
Yeah, rabbit
you're
like
it's
a
rabbit.
A rabbit. A hare. Little hare Foo-Foo.
You loved Bugs Rabbit, that irreverent cartoon character, right?
Anyways,
I like how he talked.
I had fun in the Beast World fun arc where everybody turned into beasts and then people almost died but then didn't. And then, you know, all the fun twists and turns that you love about comic books. I think this was a lot of fun.
I love the fact that the Titans read it, love the Beast, love the world, and I love number 6.
I love when Pete boils it down for like the regular Joe. He's like, these beasts, they're in the world, they're putting on their...
They beasted out. We had our normal heroes to like turn into beasts. You know, we had the Batman werewolf thing. That was cool. I had fun with that.
Yeah.
So go fuck yourself with your bullshit.
No, listen, you are right, Pete. I think one of the main things that they were going for this event was not the world changing, everything is over, cliffhanger so much as fun. And that's something that I think we've kind of been getting from a lot of the DC events since Dark Crisis on Infinite Earths. Night Terrors was that way too, where it was like, oh, this is kind of fun. And the Lazarus Planet thing was like, yeah, it's fun. I'm having a good time. They're going for sort of more little hits of what's fun and what's interesting about this stuff.
Well, and what
and
I liked
I love
about this...
The balance that they strike with that, you know what I mean? Where they don't make it too weird where it's not fun, where they kind of push the envelope enough, you know?
Well, I think I feel like unlike your classic big events where it is line defining and everyone has to put a stop to the stories they're telling to focus on the event, these events lately are sort of like, no, you can still be telling all the Batman, Superman stories concurrent to this, and it doesn't interrupt it. So that does inherently lower the stakes a little bit for a line-wide event when it's like, it's not disturbing anything else. But that's not a criticism. That's a status quo. What I like about this is that it is focused on the Titans exclusively almost. It touched everyone, but everything sort of came back to them. Nightwing was the central hero, I think, at the end.
Beast Boy was, asshole.
He wasn't the hero. He was the hero at the beginning, and then he was the victim, the rescue, the person they had to save by the end of it. I'm not saying he's not a hero, but I'm just in the narrative progression. Like he became the mission as opposed to the person executing the mission. But again, still focused on Titans. I like the way they came around and resolved the story in a way that felt good. And it really sets the Titans up for a great story going forward. Though I do think we're setting up for a Justice League Waller clash, right? Mm-hmm. Not necessarily a Titans Waller clash.
Conversely to what I just said, one of the things that got me kind of excited here is the idea that DC is doing some serious long-term planning with their storyline.
Yeah.
Like, we've talked a lot about how Amanda Waller is overexposed to the DC universe. I still feel that. She's in a lot of books and a lot of, like, here we go, I got my machinations in the background. So it's a little too much of her. But at the same time, one of the things that got me back into DC Comics was hearing that they had spent 2 years slowly seeding, if I remember correctly, it was Infinite Crisis back in the day, where just like putting little dots of things. And I love that. Like, I love just leaving things in the background. And the fact that they've since Dark Crisis had these events that just progress the story a little bit along the way, it started to get me exciting here because I know we're leading to something. I don't know what that something is. They've said literally nothing about it. It may tie into, apparently there's something that Mark Waid and Scott Snyder might be working on together that might be like actual New 52 style total reboot of big, the DC universe, like big.
Love that.
Huge change. So we'll see. Maybe they're heading towards that. Maybe those are two unrelated things. But whatever it is, like, there's an Uber story we're telling there, and I love the commitment to that.
It feels very Marvel from like 10 to 15 years ago with Waller, with sort of like Green Goblin, Dark Avengers rising here. And I think that's fun to put the Justice League, which has always been a paragon and a universally loved team, a little bit on their heels. We're getting that with Amazon's Attack and all of those sort of books that have been coming out lately, that all of our heroes are being tarnished a bit in the DC universe, which is something they haven't really done before. So that's an interesting change.
Next up, Lilo and Stitch, number one from Dynamite, written by Greg Pak, art by Julia Giacomino. This is continuing Dynamite's big push into the various Disney characters. And this is the first time that Lilo and Stitch has ever had a comic book, despite having multiple movies, multiple TV shows, and other things. What? What do you think is so funny about this?
No, nothing. Just me being stupid. Yeah.
Oh, all right.
Sorry.
In any case, this is directly following up on the movie, maybe the TV show as well. To be honest, I never watched that, but I thought this was absolutely adorable. If you like the movie, you're going to like this comic book. They capture the voices. There's fun stuff with Stitch. There's fun stuff with Lilo. You get to hear them say, Ohana means family. It hits all the hits, but it gives you exactly what you want in that heartwarming way.
Yeah, I mean, I would say this is a kick in the pants. It's really just an adorable,
and that, you mean fun, that as a good thing?
Yes.
To be clear,
yes,
that's a Greg Pak-ism.
That's right.
From years ago when he did our live show. And he said that was his big way of complimenting something, was saying it's a real kick in the pants.
Yeah, and so thank you for explaining
that's
that
his,
to the
that's his super tight bananas.
That's right.
A nonsensical
that
thing.
That started this whole thing that we've been on, yeah. So I just wish I could talk to him about some of his inspiration. You know, I wish we could kind of get deeper with him. But I think this is a ton of fun and a very adorable, that feels like they pulled it right from the TV show and the movie. So everything that Zelbatron just said.
I've never been a Lilo and Stitch guy.
What?
It's one of the misses in my Disney canon. Ooh, never. I think I've
is
made
it Lilo or Stitch that kind of keeps you at a distance?
None.
Is it Ohana? Is it family that you don't like?
Yeah, do I don't like family? That family stuff.
Yeah.
Ohana means family? Okay, well, then I don't know what that means. But no, it's just more like that came out in the period where I wasn't watching Disney movies. Now I'm definitely watching Disney movies much more. So
So you're blaming your children for this not being in the rotation.
No, it's not. I'm blaming when I didn't have children and I was doing other stuff besides like watching Disney movies.
Huh.
There's other a time stuff? In your life where you don't watch Disney movies, right?
Huh.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't remember
no?
that time.
You just no. throw a Disney movie on, you bring a date home, you're 25, and you're like, all right, let's make out. And I'm just going to put a little TV on the background. Yeah, I'm going to stitch it up.
What do you want to watch? Kronk's New Groove, or what do you want to watch?
Yeah, Brave. Ohana means getting it on to Alex, it turns out.
All right, why don't we move on and talk about Dead X-Men, number one from Marvel, written by Steve Fox, art by Jonas Scharf, Bernard Chagg, and Vincenzo Caruto. And this is very complicated, so hang in there. But back at the Hellfire Gala, the new five X-Men were voted on, and as they were coming out and being presented to everybody, they were murdered by Nimrod. They all died. Since then, Resurrection is off the table. None of the X-Men are coming back. None of the mutants are coming back or anything like that. So leading into this series, we know that these five X-Men are going to play in some way. How do they come back to life? Maybe we're going to find out in this series. We don't really, or rather, and this is the spoiler here that I was really taken aback by. They're just alive at the beginning. This is much more of an Exiles riff as a series.
Yes.
As they're jumping to different parts of the multiverse, trying to track down, I'm not even going to begin to explain what's going on with Moira McTaggart or the Dominion or anything like that.
I think it's pretty simple, Alex. Moira McTaggart is the mutant that's launched all these different things when she was resurrected multiple times. She started a new timeline, which ended up being the thing that was the different X-Men lines right at the very beginning of the Hickman run. And that led to all these different universes, which led to Fall of X, everything that has gotten us here. But we had Sinister jumped in and he got her. And he was like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to clone her multiple times so I can have several different restarts, like a save point where he can jump in and jump out, jump in, jump out, jump in, jump out.
Yeah.
Relaunch the universe so he can become a Dominion. So that's a simple thing. It's easy. You become a Phalanx and you become a giant space computer. Yeah. You know what I'm talking about. A space computer. We all want to be a space computer.
That's what everybody wants, right? They all want to be space balls.
They want to be space balls. That's what this Mr. Sinister's secret is. I'll tell you what, that's not anything we can question. We're not questioning why being a space computer is space ball. Space ball is something we all want to be, so why would we ever question what this thing is? So anyway, what's happening here is just all these different X-Men who are dead, but now they're alive. We don't know why they're alive, but they are alive. They're not the X-Men we want, they're X-Men we have. What they're going to do is they're going to go to a different universe and try to find a different Moira McTaggart universe where they can go and become that universe, track down her because so they can restart it and find a way to beat the Dominion before the Dominion becomes the Dominion. Easy.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you for explaining that. Really
appreciate
it.
Literally, that was just reading the opening matter.
Okay, so here's what I
want
to mention about this book. So I have two big thoughts about this book. One big thought is going in, I was curious to find out how are they going to bring back these X-Men since Resurrection is off the table. The whole cold open, I was like, they're not referring to this at all. It has to be at some point in the issue. And then what you just showed off is the recap page, which explains how they came back, which is basically that Professor X and Rachel Summers in the future were like, we need an X-Men team. Bring back the dead X-Men team. Now they're alive. Here we go. That's the whole explanation. And that part I was like, what that is too little, too much at the same time. The other thought I have in the other direction, but just to say something positive, is I love Exiles. If this sticks with them just jumping through the multiverse, trying to track down Moiras and do stuff, great. Super into that.
Agreed. Like, I think the run-in for this book and the page that just listed the setup, I was like, this is so intense and unnecessary. Because what we want is just like, hey, I picked this because the rationale is actually really good. There's a little bit of text page where they talk about like Rachel Summers like, I want these X-Men. And Professor is like, those shitheads? And she's like, yes, I want them. And he's like, okay, it makes sense because they will be under the radar because they're not Omega mutants. And they're still good enough because they are X-Men and they have a specific power set that we need to capture this Moira. And so I was like, yes, that's what I want. Crack team of underdog X-Men that come in and encounter a team of Starjammers where Juggernaut is like a cool teen with cool hair. You got grown-up Lockheed. You got Sunspot who looks like Mr. Fantastic. I want all of that. So my big note here is just simplify the front end and give us this like mainline shit that we're dying for. It's like the Jason Aaronification of this X-Men era, which I'm here for.
Wow. Yeah. I just want to say, Steve, I wish the X-Men were dead, Steve, and we could kind of move on from this nightmare.
You were just hoping this is like a series of gravestones in this book?
Yeah.
So just to review, Titans Beast World number 6, you love the focus on the Titans and the Beasts of the world. Lilo and Stitch, you love both the characters Lilo and Stitch. And Dead X-Men, you wish the X-Men were dead?
Yeah, because
okay,
what is going on in the X-Men book? Yeah. This is insanity.
I mean, to be fair, you're right.
All
you're right,
we need
Pete.
To do is triple down on this Moira MacTaggert shit because that's what everybody wants and is loving it. What are we doing, man?
I to the point I was making earlier, I at least partially agree with you just in the sense that I have read all this stuff. I kind of understand all this stuff, but this was a level too far of like,
it shouldn't be this hard, this, man.
Moira? It felt like, maybe I'm wrong, but it feels like we skipped an issue. It feels like maybe this was supposed to come out after Rise of the Powers of X number 2, which would explain a little bit of what's going on. Because the place that we left off there was they were like, we got to go back in time before Moira MacTaggert got her mutant powers and suss this out. And this issue, they were like, we brought back 5 X-Men, even though that's something we've said explicitly we can't do. They are trying to find Moiras from different timelines. For what reason? I'm not honestly 100% sure, having read the whole issue. And also, Professor X wants to go back in time and talk with her versus shoot her in the face, which was the implication of the last issue. So again, it feels like there's a couple of steps that were skipped there, and I don't know if we're going to get them in another issue or not.
Well, what they need to do is, to say it more slowly, is they need to get to a Moira Prodigy has a passive telepathy, so he can pull from people's brains without it being the more aggressive type of telepathy. And so he needs to pull all of the information about her lives so that before she is killed and the timeline resets, so they can try to stop it from going toward the Dominion phase. Where
do you think you're making sense right now with what you're saying? Do you think that that sounds... fun,
I'm saying the right words of what this story is, and I'm saying it slowly than
fun.
I did earlier. It is, I'm saying, I agree with you, it's overly complex, but the back half of this issue I think was fun, and this is what I want. I want the A-team of X-Men coming
there's
together to do an impossible
mission. X-Men named Random. Like, they couldn't even, there's a dude and his name is Random.
Love Random. X-Factor character from back in the day. He can make guns with his hands, Pete. That's, you love that shit.
Era. Pre. That's pre.
I was like, they're just making up fucking shit. They can't even, I felt like.
To your point, this book needs to be traveling the multiverse to find the robot lady to stop the evil space ball. That's what they need to boil it down to. There's a little too much going on.
Is it just me, or I'm tired of X-Men keep coming up with this baby Hitler problem. It just seems like X-Men stories go around. Then we're like, ooh, we kind of do this. We should go back in time and kill a baby Hitler move. And I just... why does it keep happening?
So you think your end game is Hitler becomes one of the X-Men?
That's no, what I'm Pete's just saying with Mr.
The leader of the X-Men?
No, there was just like X-Men will be like this thing where like Mr. Sinister is a real problem. Should we do a baby Hitler situation? And then it's like this Moira MacTaggert. And I was like, why does this keep coming up?
It keeps coming up because Chris Claremont back in the day wrote a classic storyline called X-Men, the baby Hitler situation. Everybody loved it. And they always want to write stuff like that. And they always want to remake it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I mean, that I'm the asshole here. I apologize.
You're not, though. I will agree with you, Pete. The multiversity of that has infected all of our culture, including the comics. What some books we're going to talk about later. I'm like, we don't need this. Let's just tell some more basic stories without starting in multiverse, starting with 50 Sabretooths.
Why don't we move on to some more basic stories then in DC Power 2024, number 1 from DC Comics, written by N.K. Jemisin, Cheryl Lynn Eaton, Lamar Giles, John Ridley, Darren Bennett, Sean Mattenborough, Aletha Martinez, Jarrett Williams, Greg Burnham, and Brandon Thomas. Art by Jamal Campbell, Isaiah Fulmore, Probably Aisha Fulmer. I probably spelled that wrong. Sean Damian Hill, Edwin Galman, Dennis Cowan, Tony Atkins and Moritat, Aletha Martinez, Dominic Domo Stanton, Janoy Lindsay, Carrie Randolph, and Serge Acuna. This is a collection of various stories that are focusing on different characters throughout the DC Universe celebrating Black History Month, or the kickoff of it, rather. But the big standout headline here is it's N.K. Jemisin and Jamal Campbell writing a new story, a epilogue to Far Sector that is so good. It brought me right back to the days of reading that amazing book. It is a wonderful addition. I absolutely loved it.
Why do we go away from amazing Far Sector stories that are just glorious? Yeah, I'm just so glad that this not only – this is an unbelievable collection of great stories and unbelievable ideas, but the starting it with like the banger one of Far Sector and Jon Stewart's Green Lantern is just awesome. It's a hell of a launching pad for this. And this is just an all-star cast making fantastic choices and just unbelievable stories here.
Yeah, you got to read – if you read any of Far Sector, this is the capstone to it. You got to read it. But I also want to shout out the John Ridley story, which I really loved, Pure Blackness, beautiful art.
Yeah.
Let me pull up the artist real quick. Also love the Spectre story, which we haven't
– they're all great.
I've been missing this Spectre. We haven't gotten Crispus in the green and white.
Crispus
in a while.
And Montoya back together. That was so great.
I love them. That was such a fun time.
Isn't exactly a question, but this is a thing that I was thinking around that I wanted to throw by you guys when I was reading that story, because that gave me that feeling of like, I love this era. And I couldn't really divorce that feeling from reading the story, which I still think was a good story, but how much does that play in when you're reading things, and how much should you divorce yourself from the view?
You shouldn't get a divorce. You should try to work it out.
Make
you
it work.
I mean? Yeah, yeah. Don't.
No, but seriously, in terms of thinking about something critically, that pleasing feeling of nostalgia you get from like, oh, I loved
why
it when
are you,
Allen was
Spectre. Why are you saying no to
because
that part
I like
of yourself.
To think about how we think about things critically. That's why.
Sure. And I can appreciate that. And listen, Cornell, sometimes it's okay to enjoy fucking things, man. All right? You don't always have to boil
I'm
things
sorry
down.
I'm sorry I didn't go to like, Pure Pleasure Ithaca College, okay?
You should have. It was a fucking ton of fun.
Wait, so and let's just remind everyone that Pete majored in Pure Pleasure, right? That's what you said, right?
I don't know about that. It was way too much fun. It was way too much fun.
Your college essay for Ithaca College was just rubbing your nipples for 5 minutes, right?
And they were like, get him in here. Number one prospect.
We need him.
We need him in this freshman class.
I did take Leisure in Society. That was an actual class that I took.
See? Of course. Ithaca's gorgeous. Major in what you want.
Come on.
To your point, to both of your points, I feel like we, for whatever reason, the question and the Spectre, we play a little fast and loose in the DC continuity. We get some Montoya question. Yeah. We less so Crispus and the Spectre lately. But I agree, like with Pete a little bit here, we're like, I just want to enjoy this story and not, because I understand in every universe, there's always a pull back to sort of the standard. And the standard is the Spectre being this figure that is just like menacing and more like cold justice. But spinning the characters out of Gotham Central into these roles is so much more interesting. And they're characters that I have much more of an affinity to. So I definitely appreciate this. I want to shout out the artist for John Ridley's story, Edwin Galman, which was just really beautiful.
Yeah. And sorry, I'm honestly forgetting. I know that the Brandon Thomas, Carrie Randolph, Serge Acuna story, that was the last one. Which story was that? Because I'm completely forgetting. Whatever it was, I remember really liking that one just because I really like that team in general. But whatever it is, great collection. Definitely pick it up. It's like over 100 pages too.
Yeah, oh yeah. You get a lot of bang for your buck on this.
Absolutely. Great, great stuff. Local Man, number 9 from Image Comics, written by Tony Fleeks and Tim Seeley.
Art by Tony. Duke, you're talking about the Duke story.
Oh, yeah. Right? Yeah, that was great. The Duke Signal story where he goes to the future and meets himself.
Yeah.
Awesome. I love that, and I love a good Kari Randolph art as well.
Yeah.
Local Man number 9 from Image Comics, written by Tony Fleeks and Tim Seeley, art by Tony Fleeks and Tim Seeley. Picking off of the big revelation of the last issue, or rather, revelation for our main character, where he realized the girl that he's been hooking up with on the side is behind everything horrible that's been happening to him this entire series. We are now dealing with the fallout from that revelation, and it is epic, it's big, and it really kicks this title into whatever the next iteration is. Continues to be great. Justin, I know you really like this in particular. Why did you like this issue?
I just love this series in general. I think this series is such a good blending of these larger superhero stories with great just like character work in this community. But more importantly, blending the tones of like high drama. There's big revelations here for two of our main characters with some great comedy. Like Tim Seeley is great at doing both of those things. And the moment when he's like, he accidentally confesses to the husband who's a cop that he's been sleeping with his wife was played for fun, but also had huge ramifications for the rest of the issue. Big emotional issue. If I've said this before, but if you're a fan of the famous Hawkeye run, the Matt Fraction, David Aja run, pick this up, because I think it's right there.
Yeah, I think this is great. I really love the horseshoe moment. I thought that was really fun. There's just it's an amazing team. You know, this is in such great hands. So it's really impressive the depth of everything that you get in this, in the story here. Plus, there's tons of action and other stuff going on as well. And the art is just phenomenal.
One more thing I want to say, like, there's no better story. I think there's a great trend that I really enjoy where you have your backup that comments on the main story's action. Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone's doing it better than Local Man, because the backups are fleshing out the world in such a way that just is so exciting.
Yeah. Drive Like Hell, number 4 from Dark Horse Comics, written by Rich Dueck, art by Alex Cormack. This is the final issue of the series, which is basically Fast and Furious Goes to Hell. This ended great. I thought I really had a blast reading this series. It gets bigger in terms of the action. This issue, the way that they figure out the problem at the end, is very fun and silly. There's kind of a goofy tone that runs through this entire book, even with the big stakes that are going on, that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, I loved all the action, the car racing, the truck, all that kind of like smash 'em up kind of stuff. It was insane and over the top and cool ways. And the art was such a cool kind of like style to set up this kind of like fast paced kind of car thing. So, yeah, I just felt like it really checked a lot of boxes for me. And the team was really good at getting this kind of vision across. I had a great time with it.
Agree. We've talked to to Rich a couple times, and this book has come up a lot. Fantastic. I was worried that they were going to deal with a bunch of sad things happening in this book, and instead, we just had the fun. So shouts to that. I really thought we were going to have a whole situation where the girlfriend was going to die, and instead, we just had some fun, and I appreciate that.
Yeah. Shouts to pure pleasure at all costs. You know?
Right? My guy Pete.
Avengers Inc. number 5 from Marvel, written by Al Ewing, art by Leonard Kirk. This is the final issue of this series, the final abbreviated issue, even though they did finish up the story. We've been following a detective agency with out-of-costume Avengers run by the Wasp. Turns out her enemy in the background was none other than Hank Pym, the original Ant-Man, who is putting together a new lethal legion to try to stop Ultron, which has infected his brain. It's a little complicated, picks up on a couple of different storylines that have run not just through Al Ewing's work, but also a very long history with Hank Pym as well. And we, mild spoilers here, but we end up with a new iteration of Ultron. We end up with a new status quo for Hank Pym. We end up maybe with a new team of Avengers at the end here. I will say I was really in the tank for the series, and I still think that are Kirk's art is great. The action is very dynamic throughout. Yao Ewing knows his way to rounding around a story. But man, you could really feel that they reduced this from 10 issues to 5 issues. And it's such a bummer that more people didn't read this, because I would love more original ideas like Avengers solving noir mysteries. And that's not what we got. We got that for 3 issues, and then it very quickly wrapped up. And that stinks.
Well, I mean, when you say it like that, now it's not fun to talk about. So thanks a lot. But yeah, I thought, first off, the inking and the art style in this was such a cool kind of vibe and tone for this book, with all the action and kind of, I just felt like it did such a great job of kind of sucking you into this different, a little different than what you're kind of used to when it comes to kind of Marvel art. So I really appreciated that. Yeah. And I just felt like, you know, it was just like a big, fun kind of action thing that, you know, I mean, maybe was smashed together, but I appreciated all the action at once. You know what I mean? I felt like it was very economical.
The whole time I was reading this last issue, I was thinking about you, Alex, because I know how much you love this book. And I actually thought it was nice. They brought it to a nice close. Mm-hmm. I don't know if anyone will follow up with these threads, but this is the first time I've really enjoyed where the Wasp took center stage and was able to be like a real leader in recent Marvel continuity. So that was cool. The idea that someone's going to pick up and be like, the character I want to deal with, Uncle Mark, who's Ultron sort of. I was like, I don't know if we're taking this thread to the next level.
Well, we'll see. I mean, Al Ewing has shown that he went from a Ant-Man series to a Wasp series to this series, which is a direct sequel to that. Maybe he's got more in him. Maybe we got Uncle Mark is coming.
This guy loves bugs.
Loves bugs. Batman and Robin 2024 annual number 1 from DC Comics, written by Joshua Williamson, art by Howard Porter. In this oversized issue, Batman and Robin go on a good old father-son bonding road trip. They go camping and nothing bad happens to them, and that's pretty much the end of the issue.
Go fuck yourself, man. No, I had a blast with this, and I don't
appreciate it. Why go fuck yourself is what I'm saying. There's no reason to go.
He was like, this is not... No, this is...
No, I was making a joke about how, of course, things happen to them. They're Batman and Robin.
That's what comics are.
Yeah, they're not going to have an issue where they go on a camping trip and nothing happens to them. I was joking with her.
Let me ask you, Pete, did you really think that Alex thought nothing happened in this
issue? No, but I think that he was being cavalier with how they were like, we're going to go and rough it. We're leaving our weapons and stuff at home, and we're going to go.
That's literally the premise of this comic.
I know. And so what I'm saying is I thought it was a fun idea, very well executed. A touch of sweetness to it. I love when Batman is a big softy when it comes to Robin. So I thought this was adorable and a great kind of bonding time for old Bats and Robbie. And yeah, so I didn't like the undertone of what he was doing.
There's no undertone.
I think there's no undertone. I think Alex liked this issue. Tone.
I did.
I also like this issue. The Howard Porter art is really nice. Oh. Joshua Williamson, just great at getting into a boots-on-the-ground character story that is both sweet and action-forward. Let me ask you guys, what's your experience camping? How hard have you guys roughed it lately?
Oh, well, lately? Not lately, no, but as a kid, you know, my dad had like a scoutmaster that he was all about, and this guy was like
all about.
Well, he was kind of like a father figure to my dad. No, he was like a father.
He was a dad's dad.
Yeah, and so he would like go and drop them in the middle of the woods, and then drive away, and they had to like figure out, you know, forage to get kind of shelter and food and all sorts of crazy stuff. So I got all sorts of insane stories. So when we went camping, and we had like canned food and stuff like that, my dad would complain, but my mom was like, the kids gotta eat, Bill, come on.
Because your dad would be like, I'm gonna eat this squirrel's head.
Yeah, he was like, I'm gonna go fishing for, you know, food. And you know,
How did he do? Did he have any canned food, or is he fully sustaining on the land?
Oh, he had some canned food. Yeah.
Did your dad participate in the TV show alone? Was he a contestant on the...
No. But he was the... I mean, the dude was real deal. Like, he could hunt fish the whole night.
Should we do alone, the three of us?
Naked and Afraid?
Is that not Naked and Afraid. Oh. We are that already. We're already that. Alone is where you go in the woods and you have to, like, survive for as long as you can. And if you almost die, they take you home.
Oh. But you're, like, you're glamping at the same time, right? Like,
nope, you're like not. There's very little glamp.
Camping story queued up for us here? Or?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, I could say my experience with camping, but this is 100% a trap. I know this is a trap because of I grew up in a tent.
Yeah.
This is how I'm the coolest.
I grew up in the woods.
I'm upstate New York. I have no trap. I'm just curious.
I drink wild water. I have no teeth.
I'm sitting at a campfire right now.
Yeah, that's right. What is this? What is all this inside stuff? This machine that makes coffee. How does that work? I just eat dirt, and that gives me energy.
No, we used to go camping all the time too. Usually, like, my mom didn't really like to go camping.
Central Park.
Yes. When I say camping, I mean we would go to the Museum of Natural History and look at the animals in there. That's camping, right?
That's No,
the room that's like a little bit darker than the other room.
It's terrifying.
We used to go up the Adirondacks all the time.
Yeah, no.
I honestly don't know where we went, but we go a lot with like my dad and my uncle. And my brother eventually. So there you go.
We killed someone. So great book.
Man, I don't really talk about it too much. But that man was Dead Lucky, just like the Dead Lucky number 11 from Image Comics, written by Melissa Flores, art by French Carlo Magno. We are following a bunch of different characters in a futuristic version of San Francisco as part of this massive verse series. Things are getting real complicated here, I got to say.
Yeah.
I like this book, but there's a lot of characters. And maybe you guys had an easier time following the action here because I'm starting to get a little bit lost.
I hear you on that. I love this series in its first, like, six issues because it felt like really different and dealing with PTSD in an interesting way as a filter to sort of use superheroes as a way to examine PTSD, which I really liked. And then, yes, it's gotten a bit complex with some of the world building. I thought the back half of this issue, though, really is getting us back to a big confrontation where maybe we will sort of be able to bring these themes together and cut through sort of the more complex story that has been adding up.
Yeah, I just I hear what you're saying. This did have a lot of badass fighting in it, which I really loved. And the art is just, very enjoyable. That was cool.
Well, why don't we move on to another book where the art is very enjoyable. Somna, number 2 from Distillery, written and drawn by Becky Cloonan and Tula Lote. We actually missed the first issues of both of Distillery's big books, Gone by Jock and Somna by these people that I just mentioned. So hopefully we're going to try to catch up with them because I do think what this publisher is doing is very interesting. They're doing limited runs, limited print runs of things. They're doing them. You could buy limited digital runs as well, which gets into all sorts of issues I'm sure we could talk about at some point. But here, the idea of this book is it is set around Salem witch trial times, I guess we can call them. We're following a woman who is married to a witch hunter who has previously had to put down a witch in the previous issue. Meanwhile, she herself is having nightmares or dreams about a demon or the devil who is visiting her as night is becoming increasingly sexual as it goes. This demon or devil might be visiting other women as well. Maybe it's real, maybe it's not. And that's what we're following up on in this issue as things get even worse in this tiny little pre-colonial town. What'd you guys think about this one?
I love this.
Don't read it in public.
I love this. Like, this is the different art styles that are blended here between the dream world and the reality of our characters here, I thought was fantastic. The story's great. It's a story set in sort of the Salem and witch world that feels different. It feels more intimate and more sort of like in the room than so many stories like that feels like you're just observing and it's very moralistic and whatnot. This feels very is character driven, and I really like sort of riding along in the whole thing. It feels like
not the Scarlet Letter when you read it in high school, but the Demi Moore Scarlet Letter, like a little more
Scarlet.
I mean, you know, you guys tell me. I mean, do you guys have conversations with your wives about like if you have sex with the devil in your dreams, does that count as cheating? Because like I feel like you know, you can do whatever you want in your dreams, but when you walk in the door and you see your wife naked, dangerously close to a fire, clearly getting fucked by something that isn't there. At that point, you got to be like, hey, this isn't cool. Like, dream fucking's one thing, but like, you know.
No, we're pretty open. We have like a thruple / open relationship with the devil. So, like, it's pretty chill.
Devil's your wife's hall pass? Yeah, mine too.
Is that a red flag or a beige flag?
Like, well, it's definitely
the devil's
red.
My whole red pass.
Yes. I will say on that moment, and this is a spoiler for the end of this issue that you're talking, but you already mentioned it, Pete. And that moment is very dramatic, but it also was very funny trying to think about, like, I absolutely thought about it in a modern context. You walk in and your wife is like sort of distended.
Sex. No, mid-sex or the devil.
Mid-sex with nobody. Naked. Completely naked in front of a fire and being like, oh no, the devil has my wife. I was like, buddy, I got some news.
Just from a fire perspective, she must have like just loaded a bunch of logs on it because that fire is raging. So you think the devil is like,
no, I think when the devil's, like, the flames go up, I don't think she did that. I think the devil's, like, you know.
The devil's having sex and also managing the fire?
No, I think anytime like a devil scout? Is close, the fire's going to go up.
I'm stoking two fires.
I mean, we've all walked in on a partner who's, like, naked, having sex with a devil.
We have? Yeah. We all have. Is that something that's happened to you a lot?
Yeah, and there. So then, what happens is like, well, okay, tit for tat. I lay down in front of a fire. And I'm like, all right, come at me, somebody.
Lay there. And say,
I'm waiting for an angel.
With a sexy female fox from Robin Hood.
Dream. My hall pass. Marion, my dog. Oh my God. Let's go.
Too much talk about how sexy Robin Hood the fox is. Not enough talk about how sexy Maid Marian the fox is.
I mean, they could both be sexy without. That's why they get together. That's sexy.
We need to.
I don't know what's happened anymore.
I'm not sure. This is a absolutely gorgeous book. We have two artists at the top of their game.
It's unbelievable.
Tula Lotte, if you haven't seen her work on Barnstormers and other things, absolutely phenomenal. So Becky Cloonan, I just wanted to shout out in particular as somebody that we followed through so much of her career. She's doing such interesting things with the angles in her book and the characters. You know, there's a little bit of like, clearly she has her own style, but there was a little bit of the main character that feels to be a little Gabriel Rodriguez she's channeling at certain points.
Yeah.
And a lot of, there's some angles, some specific panels with the statues in particular that feel very Mignola-esque to me as well. So again, Becky Cloonan, very much her own artist, doing her own thing, but I feel like she's shouting out different things at different points as well. It's just, it's great to see these two people working together. It's, again, gorgeous looking book, very much adults only. But like you said, it's taking a very different look at this. The characters are interesting. I'm really curious to see where this goes.
Last thing I want to shout out the colorists, Lee Lowridge, Dee Conniff, and Tula Lotte. The colors are fantastic in this book on both sides of the art front, from the Tula stuff and the Becky stuff. It's just really, the eye work on the Becky Cloonan pages is so good.
Yeah. Spider-Boy number 3 from Marvel, written by Dan Slott. Excuse me, art by Paco Medina and Ty Templeton. I'm crying because I love it so much. This is two stories of Spider-Boy. In the front story, we are getting him dealing with being poor. And in the backstory, he's fighting alongside Thor. So it rhymes. So that's fun. Poor and Thor, yes. I really enjoy this book. This is a great all-ages book, like I've said with the previous issues. But one thing that I'll quibble with a little bit, I think Dan is riffing off of the classic Peter Parker never having enough money for stuff in the front story and what he's doing with Bailey Bass. When it's Peter Parker, who is a 20-year-old, and he's like, ah, geez, how am I going to pay rent? It's like fun, you know, like it's like a classic thing. Like, oh boy, what is he going to do now? What pictures of Spider-Man is he going to sell? When it's a child who's like, I don't have enough money to buy my food to eat, it's a little sad.
Well, I agree with you. I feel like, you know, we love Dan Slott. I feel like he's playing a little fast and loose with the situation, like playing the situation where, like, he's literally, Spider-Boy is literally an orphan who has, who's he staying with a family in a homeless shelter. And they're pretty like, I just need some money. I'm just like, ah, there's a lot of information here that feels a little bit mismatched from the stakes that are happening. But having said that, like, I really like the action here. I like sort of the villain that is created slash slight spoiler hero. And then the backup, I like this idea that Spider-Boy is a monster as well, that he has to, it takes the Spider-Man, the mythos, and puts it in a slightly different way. And that's nice. That's more interesting to me than some of the stuff happening in the front story.
Yeah, Dan Slott's clearly having a blast here, and I'm happy for Dan. And I think the art does a great job of matching the brightness and kind of fun tone. It's almost like a cartoonish kind of a look to it, which I think does a great job of matching what's going on. So, yeah, when you open it up, you kind of really feel what you're going to get, and they do a great job of delivering on that. And sure, yeah, if you stop and slow down and think about Spider-Man too hard, you're going to find some sad stuff. So just keep it moving. You know what I mean?
No, you can think about sad stuff.
Nope, keep it moving.
That's what life is.
Keep happy. Pleasure at all costs. Batman off
world. Pure pleasure. Pure pleasure, LePage.
Nothing bad here. That's the motto of Ithaca College, right? Nothing bad here.
Yeah.
Don't fucking
no notes.
Certainly, college, bro. It certainly implies that something is bad there. I'm just going to say.
That's Batman, not the fucking slogan. Don't fucking try to come for Ithaca, bro.
Ithaca college. Is gorgeous. Gorgeous full of corpses. Ithaca is corpses.
Yeah. Ithaca College, nothing in that barn. Batman off world.
Dude, this is not a fun bid that you're doing. You know what I mean?
What are you protecting your alma mater? Are you really? Are you that?
You can't come for Ithaca, dude. You know what I mean? Like,
as a town or as a college?
As a college.
I would never come for Ithaca as a town. Never. I love Ithaca. College town bagels?
Yeah.
You guys fight more about college than anyone I know. And by the way, college, long time ago, my guys.
Long time ago.
Why is this a top of mind?
I just hate this top of the hill fucking mentality looking down at this.
What? This isn't upstairs, downstairs.
Sorry, what were you saying earlier to the camping section about growing up and drinking well water? How long ago was that specifically?
My college was drinking beaver piss in the woods. So, and I graduated.
I want to talk about Batman Offworld. I love this comic.
Great. For number three from DC Comics, written by Jason Aaron, art by Doug Mankey. Pete, take it away.
Yeah, so this is just love this kind of Batman training himself off-world, this kind of, like, quest that he's going on. I love that he's got a giant space wolf with him now. This is just, like, fun things that I feel like I would do with Batman if I was, you know, like, writing Batman. And, so I just feel like this is such a cool idea, really well executed. I just think the art and the pace of this is just really great.
Batman as drawn by Doug Mankey as Frank Frazetta in space with a techno wolf is just dope. And Jason Aaron's story, like, I've been really enjoying this. Superman Lost has been really nice to see these characters like, I'm in space, I'm away from stuff. I do think it's funny that both of these books, Superman, like, has sort of a relationship, but then by the end of the book, he's like, no, nothing happened there. And same thing with Batman. He, like, is about to kiss this girl, and he's like, I can't. And I'm like, Catwoman, that's not a, they're not together. Like, what, can't Batman
we
kiss
were on a break.
Space girl? Yeah, let's I want to have romance. I want this romance to happen. Let's go.
Foulmouth, number one, written by Stephen.
What, no take, Alex?
Oh, no, I don't really have anything to add other than, yes, this book is dope, super fun. I'm surprised that they finished up the main action so quickly and are moving on to something else. But I think that's part of probably what he's trying to say about Batman is the fight is never done. So it's cool. It's
literally, great, Batman says, I feel like I'm not done here, and no one knows what's happening. And suddenly it cuts to like two evil people who we haven't met before. It's like, oh, okay, Batman, whatever you got to do, my man.
Foulmouth, number one, written by Steve Renna, art by Sarah Davidson. A couple of months back, maybe longer, we talked to Steve about this book back when he was kickstarting it, and he sent it our way to take a look at it. So the idea here is regular old girl gets infected with a demon who gives her the power to create constructs every time she creatively curses. I, even having talked to Steve about it, liked his stuff before, I was like, I don't know how this is going to work. I'm not sure. This is great. This made me laugh out loud several times. Oh, I think it's so creative with the cursing and the execution. It builds really, really nicely. And Sarah David's characterizations, there's one battle when the main girl first gets infected by a demon and just has this long tongue hanging out and big eyes that is just hilarious on its own. I thought this was great.
Yeah, Green Lantern for swearing? I'm in.
Yes, please. Yeah. Yeah, I think this is a really fun, well-executed idea. I love the creative premise of it. It's really just artistically fantastic. And yeah, I love the power of swearing. It's fucking awesome.
I see what you did there. Anyway, this is great. Definitely pick this up wherever you can. Next up, The Incredible Hulk, number 8 from Marvel, written by Philip Kennedy Johnson, art by Nick Klein. It's the final issue of this arc as Hulk teams up with a Ghost Rider from World War II to fight a big evil goop monster that's invading his mind. Pete, you seem excited, so take it away.
Yeah, man, I can't wait until the next time I see Philip Kennedy Johnson because this is awesome. This is just such a epic, cool, badass Hulk story. You have Ghost Rider teaming up with Hulk and just this giant evil monster that they work together to take down. Just awesome. I mean, this is what I wanted. This is the fun of having a Hulk comic, and the art is just so epic and does such a great job of rising to this challenge and making everything look just so badass.
Yeah, the art's fantastic here. The leaning into the horror in a different way from the Al Ewing run, I think, is hard to do and a pleasant surprise that it's going so well.
Worth it for the art alone.
World Tree, number 7 from Image Comics, written by James Tynion IV, art by Fernando Blanco. We are continuing to jump between multiple timelines as we find out more about this evil internet underneath the internet. After not exactly a break, but a little bit of a pause in the previous issue, we're starting to heat things up again with some big revelations. This is a fantastic series with some gorgeous art and twisty-turny storytelling. If you're not reading this, you're missing out.
I really enjoyed this as well. There are a lot of characters in this book right now, and we're jumping through into different areas with them. This feels like something... This is one of those books that I'm like, I should reread the previous issue before I read the issue in the stack because it's really good, but there is a lot to just keep going. A lot like the internet where you have to really have it all in your head.
You gotta start at the beginning. When I hit something new, I'm like, I gotta go back and read everything on the internet first.
Yeah, every day I wake up and I start with E-Bombs World and just go forward from there.
Wow. What is that banana have for me today?
I mean, we've talked a lot
it's
about
peanut how, butter jelly time, I say.
I think we've talked a lot about how great this is, and this continues to be really creative and interesting and cool and really well executed. So looking forward to more and seeing how this madness ends.
Yep. I also appreciate one of the upcoming covers has the naked lady on the cover, but she's conveniently covered by a railing on all of her naughty bits. So, like, good job.
That's the way I am when I'm waiting to have sex with some sort of devil in front of the fire.
So you're just naked, waiting to get railed? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Exactly. But I put some Austin Powers style vases and stuff in front of
Reminded me of. This book, that's a great comparison. If you loved Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me specifically, you are going to love World Tree.
No.
Avengers Twilight, number 2 from Marvel, written by Chip Zdarsky, art by Daniel Acuña. This is a dystopian future where Avengers seemingly are no longer needed, yet turns out it's actually a fascistic state that is pushing down people. And this issue, now that Captain America has his super soldier powers back, is trying to fight back against them. He is not very successful this issue.
No, someone handed him the mic and he didn't have the juice. You know what I'm talking about? Palms are sweaty. Mom's spaghetti. Not ready for it. You know what I'm talking about? That's what Cap was not ready for, you know?
We got it.
I really like the Daniel Acuña art in this. I think it really helps to establish this futuristic nightmare world. And then, you know, we've seen dystopian like this before. But I like this version of it. I like how we get to really suffer alongside Cap as he tries to figure this out.
Yeah, I agree. Tonally, the art is really impressive with the darker colors here to kind of match this darker future. It's a really cool kind of iconic look to it. You got old Steve here. One of the panels was just so powerful. It was Red Skull kind of holding a decapitated kind of head from Ultron. So pretty just kind of badass artistically.
Since you already mentioned the spoiler of the issue, just to jump into that a little bit, I do really like this comic. I think, like you said, Daniel Acuña's art is absolutely gorgeous throughout. It also, not to be too repetitive, but really does match the tone of everything that Chip Zdarsky is going for. But I do wonder, not to jump too far ahead, what we're going to land on in terms of the themes of this book, because the idea that Cap is a man, once again, out of time and not able to connect with people and say, hey, fight against this fascistic state. But everybody's like, nah, man, I'm too busy. I don't care. That's interesting. It's something that I don't think I've seen before. The revelation this issue that it's Red Skull and Ultron behind everything means that maybe we're heading towards like classic superhero fisticuffs, which seems to work against that potentially more interesting and complicated premise. So I don't know. A lot of it is going to be the execution over the next couple of issues. I'm curious to see where it goes. I will say Tom Brevoort in his newsletter hyped up the next issue as, I believe he said, if not one of, maybe the best single issue of Avengers he's edited in 26 years. So
wow.
That's a lot of pressure to put on that issue, but I don't know. We'll see.
Well, that's really exciting because I like the ideas at play here. The idea that in the past, Captain America does a rallying speech. Everyone's like, yes, I believe in America. And I think that's a very topical idea that actually speech is devalued in our current society because everyone's talking all the time on any sort of social media or public network in some capacity. So it has to change. And Luke Cage's speech is like, hey, no, we're just going to keep doing what we do because that's what we do. That's a good flip for Cap, where it actually isn't about being inspiring. It's about doing stuff, something that he also does, but is usually it's more about him being inspiring. So very much looking forward to the next issue.
Batman Superman World's Finest 2024 Annual number 1 from DC Comics, written by Mark Waid and Cullen Bunn, Dennis Culver, Stephanie Williams, and Christopher Cantwell, art by Edwin Galmon, Travis Mercer, Rosie Camp, and Jorge Fornes. We are following a bunch of different stories in the world's finest part of the DC universe that Mark Waid has set up, including some bad stuff coming for the fifth dimensional imps. What'd you guys think about this one? Pete, I think you like this one, right?
No, I just farted while you were talking. I think that this, you know, the, oh, is it weird when someone goes over the line for you? Is it not enjoyable?
It's just like, I don't know. It's more of a college kind of thing.
Everyone has different lines.
Yeah, there we go. Fucking top of the hill over here. Yeah, I just think that it's a fun collection of stories. Cute, adorable, kind of like, you know, young them. So that's just, I mean, it's fun.
It's Mitzelplick babies.
Yeah. You know, Muppet Babies, who gets started that? So, yeah, I'm having a great time.
The Metamorphosed story is sort of like very dramatic and sad for Metamorpho, I thought. Mm-hmm. Sort of a surprising, like, where he's like, oh, I love this girl, but her dad is a jerk, but I work for him. I was like, this is very much like a sort of Patrick Dempsey movie plot in a weird way. The story I liked and I would love to see more of is the Challenge of the Unknown story at the end. That
was awesome.
Really
good. Christopher Cantwell, Jorge Fornes on art, really just to the point of sad. Like, it's really heartbreaking what they're going through, but
yeah,
it's dealt with structurally in such an interesting way. Jorge Fornes, of course, is always breaking up the paddle form in a fascinating way as well. Really, really good stuff. I really like that.
Really, really love that. I thought it was funny in the, I think the second page of this story, they're like, here we go forward into the unknown. And I feel like if you're on Challengers of the Unknown, mm-hmm. you shouldn't really be using Challengers or Unknown in your just daily.
Of the? Is of the okay?
Yeah, you could throw that.
Oh, you could all the prepositions. All the shit out of stuff, yeah.
But if you're just like, what do you guys want to get for lunch? It's like, let's get something unknown. It's like, okay, well, we don't need to always be challenging the unknown.
Yeah. You don't talk about your job. Your favorite shuttle disaster?
Whoa. Jesus, guy.
I have so many.
Oh, my God. How could you choose? Anyway, number five from Image Comics, written by Jonathan Luna and Crystal Wood, art by Jonathan Luna. This is following a quest that several people on. And in this issue, a demon heart goes into a lady. What'd you guys think?
Yeah, this lives up to the name. This is quite a... quite a quest that they're on, and you know, I hate
by the way,
it.
I just want to clarify: we've all read the issue. Go on, Pete. Yeah.
No, I hate it.
I hate it,
and I'm sure you guys can relate to this. I hate
these
it
when X-Men truly are dead.
I hate it when you
this kill- beast world is full of titans.
I hate it when you kill a demon and then their spirit goes into your heart. You know, mm-hmm. it's just so annoying, you know, because it's like you killed the demon, it should be over, but it, yeah. They stick
around.
Get out
of my heart.
Yeah, get out of my heart, man.
It's like cholesterol.
Yeah.
That's my demon.
Don't get started. Yeah, I think this is really cool. Great action, a lot of gore. And
by the way, did I tell you guys about the other day when my wife came home and she found me naked in front of an iron, just like going ham on some cheese? And she was like, "No, that's your devil. Your yeah. devil is getting into your heart."
Alex fucks cheese.
I wasn't fucking it, unless I was putting it naked in one of my holes, but it was my mouth hole.
Oh, boy.
Shouts to that. Keep that up. You chose the right hole.
I was over the line with fart humor, and you're fucking railing yourself with cheese. All right, cool guy.
That's top of the hill, Pete. That's top of the hill.
Cheese rails all the way.
This is your classic Luna Brothers story with lots of random stabbing and big emotional tragedy at the same time. I did like Sword and some of the other Luna Brothers stuff, so this does scratch an itch for me.
Great. I'm very happy for you. Carnage number 3 from Marvel, written by Torin Grumbach, art by Per Perez. We are following two Carnages now, an old Carnage who loves setting himself on fire and a young Carnage who is Carnage. And meanwhile, Flash Thompson is being framed for Carnage's crimes in a absolutely awful way. I still was not looking forward to a Carnage book. And even though I like Torin Grodbeck and I like Per Perez on the art, and I like the first two issues of this, going into this, I was like, ah, Carnage, no thank you. But every issue, this gets me. It is just very intense. If you're a fan of movies like Seven, I guess, is probably the best comparison here. Yeah. Things like that, that are just gruesome and twisty. This is great.
Yeah, this book does a good job of combining sort of like philosophical horror with actual body horror. And it's a Carnage that isn't just like a laughing sociopath, which I think is sort of like the standard Carnage. And I like this feels like it. There's more meaning happening here. And we're setting up for a great Flash anti-Venom versus Carnage battle.
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested in where this is going. I'm not having as much fun with the, like, you know, eating somebody and then puking them back up just to kind of like consume them again a little bit. So that part was a little too much. But
have you ever had a dog? That's what they do all the time. They barf stuff up and then consume it later.
Yeah. Oh, okay. They eat their own barf. He wasn't talking.
I was just wondering because I don't remember my dog like hanging up its meat and then cutting it open and eating its fucking brains. You know what I mean?
What breed did you have? A lot of breeds do that.
I had a Carnage Shepherd.
Oh, yeah. That'll
a symbiote. Symbiote terrier.
Yep. It was a crossbreed. Alan Scott, The Green Lantern, number 4 from DC Comics, written by Tim Sheridan, art by Cian Torme. Last issue, we found out that the secret identity of Red Lantern, the villain who has been plaguing our main Green Lantern, is in fact his ex-boyfriend. This issue, it gets worse. Like, I legitimately thought we were going to have a heartwarming, emotional twist in this issue. But instead, Tim Sheridan stabs the knife right into your heart, twists it around, pulls out your heart, and makes you look at it the entire time. Which is to say, fantastic emotional stakes set up in this issue. Cian Torme also drawing the heck out of it. There is a scene late in the issue where... spoilers here, but Alan Scott is on one side of an energy construct and Red Lantern is on the other side and he emotionally connects with him.
So good.
Felt everything over the course of that scene. This book is punching so far above his weight. If you're not picking it up, what are you doing? Go do that right now.
to find, I mean, this is sort of like the villain tell all issue. And to find those emotional connective moments at a time where the villain is twisting the knife, I thought was amazing. I want to shout out this great 1-2 punch at the beginning of the issue where Red Lantern's talking about how he rose through the Russian military. I'd heard they sometimes pluck soldiers from the field and turn them into spies. Next page. So I let him pluck me. And it's him. They're buttoning their clothes after they had sex, presumably.
Yeah.
Just perfectly done wordplay and well done across the from the visual, and the fact that it was across a page I thought was excellent. So just really well plotted. And then the last page I thought was absolutely badass. This series is great.
Yeah, agreed with everything that's being said. It's really impressive, the twists and turns here. They're really kind of playing with our emotions in all the right ways, but it's also a kind of heartbreaking, insane ending. I really artistically, the Red Lantern stuff is just really all sorts of villainous in all the great ways. So it's heartbreaking, but it's also kind of worth it and really creatively awesome.
Wolverine number 42 from Marvel, written by Benjamin Percy and Victor Laval, art by Corey Smith. This is continuing the Sabretooth War storyline, where Sabretooth, in order to celebrate Wolverine's birthday, has brought a bunch of Sabretooth throughout the multiverse to kill absolutely everybody that he loves and cares about in front of him. They've already killed Dokken, they've killed Quentin Quire, and now they're coming after everybody else, particularly Laura, aka X-23, but the rest of X-Force as well. How is this going on at the same time as X-Force is, I guess, one of my big questions.
Yeah.
This is so insanely intense and gross. Which is exactly what it should be, given a Sabretooth birthday surprise, like a classic Sabretooth birthday surprise. But this is a lot, and we just talked about Carnage two books ago.
Yeah, it's really insane. It's first off, it's a little disappointing that, you know, like every year Sabretooth attacks Wolverine on his birthday. So the fact that like Sabretooth got the drop on Wolverine this year is a little disappointing. I understand how he did it. He overpowered him with all these Sabretooths. That makes sense. But the fact that Wolverine was just kind of like, oh, what? Oh,
it's okay. Lucy with the football. If like Lucy absolutely ripped apart Snoopy and then showed,
I know, but just like have some respect for the reader.
50 headless Lucys with show and up just be to like, kill.
Wolverine, have him know what day is coming. Have him at least like get prepared and then get killed. You know what I mean? The fact that he's like, oh, what? You know, and then, you know, I just was like, come on, man. Like, this isn't the first time Sabretooth has done this. So, like, why are we acting like it is?
Pete, Wolverine's busy. Have you seen his Google calendar? It's insane. He's got layers on layers.
I tried to get
meetings.
A meeting with him twice, and it's like
he's in Zoom. So he can't remember. It's his birthday.
And
he's
he has a recurring meeting. Sabretooth is going to try to kill everybody I love, but like it doesn't pop up a notification, so he forgets about it. You know.
Yeah, 100%. I do like this. This feels like true end of days X-Men story where they're like, yeah, we did the Beast thing where there are like 10 Beasts and 50 Wolverines. So now we're going to do 100 Sabretooths and I don't know, whatever else. It feels like weird math. It's like story math of like, let's get this crazy. The Laura stuff in this issue, tragic. I actually really like X-Force being here in this. I like the sort of turnaround we get in this issue. The fact that this is part two of 12 is insane. I feel like this is literally the penultimate issue. Wolverine cuts off through his ligaments, leaving his adamantium bones. He's fighting Sabretooth with like weird soup hands that I'm like, what? How is this part two? This is the beginning. He's got soup hands.
Soup hands and part two.
Soup hands.
Well, I think that's, despite everything that I said, why I think this is so great right now, because you expect exactly like Pete's saying, you always expect soup heads. Expect that Sabretooth versus Wolverine is going to be tragic. It's going to be gut-wrenching, emotional. Yeah. So they know that. So they are basically like, what if we write the last Sabretooth versus Wolverine story, what would that be like? And it's not going to be. There's going to be more than them. But the fact that they are really going for it and putting absolutely everything on the table here is great. I imagine there's going to be some sort of time travel involved at some point, because how else do you fix any of this? Right?
Well, I think they're going to since this is a 12-part story, right? I think they're just going to run it through to when the X universe somehow reboots.
But
I don't know. Maybe you're right. Maybe there will be that. But I feel like run it out. Benjamin Percy writes like he's literally driving a go-kart off a cliff. He's like, let me just finish this.
I just think that, like, you know, Wolverine soup pants moving forward is going to be a tough sell. You know what I mean?
You think that's the new status quo? He's got soup pants for
that. Yeah. Because Superhead.
Well, what if we've never found out a secondary mutation. What if his secondary mutation is soup out of his hands?
That would be awesome.
He's definitely making a lot of minestrone right now. Looks like he's got pure minestrone coming out of his hands.
Nothing better happened to X-23 because she's my goddamn favorite.
Yeah. Last thing that I'll say, and then we can move on. How Corey Smith is drawing anguished Wolverine is so hard to see, so particularly because we've had years at this point of Wolverine being like, yeah, nothing phases me. To see something phase him is like, oh no, this is bad.
This also, is the claws bad. In the side of the head by X-23 was really awesome.
That was great. Stuff.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
I'm the best there is at what I do, and what I do is put chili out my right hand. Yeah, stuff out my left.
Different soups for each hand, or is it the same soup?
Yeah, no, it's soup of the day. That's his day.
Yeah, he's got one soup of the day. He's got one standard.
What soup du jour? Soup of the day. Ooh, that sounds nice. I'll have that.
Great.
The hardest question is to ask Wolverine what his left hand soup of the day is. I would.
You don't want to know what my right hand soup of the day is.
It's Italian wedding, bub.
Don't make me pop my soup. Dark Ride number 10 from Image Comics, written by Joshua Williamson, art by Andre Bresson. We're finally getting to it here and finding out the mythology of this dark, devil-infused theme park where nobody's getting fucked in front of a fire, but several people are getting torn apart.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I really like this book. We talked to Joshua Williamson a little bit about it when he was on the show.
We did.
Yes. So I love the mythology that is building here. I love finding out that maybe the people we thought were evil are maybe not quite evil in exactly the same way. There's some great twists and turns. And of course, Andre Bresson's art, just his creature designs in particular, are so cool.
Oh, my God.
There's a great death in the middle of this issue that is just immaculately done by Andre Bresson. This book, two issues left, I believe, to close out the story. And this has been like so many twists and turns. I've just loved this. Great follow up to Birthright. I hope this team keeps making stuff forever.
Pete, too scary for you?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's too scary, but artistically, it's really impressive.
Deadly Hands of Kung Fu Gang War, number 2 from Marvel, written by Greg Pak, art by Kayo Majado. We are following Shang-Chi as ostensibly he's supposed to stay out of the gang war. He gets kind of suckered into it in this issue. And by the end, the villains aren't coming for him. The heroes are. Pete, what'd you think about this? More not as scary?
Yeah, this was great. I kind of really enjoy the Shang-Chi kind of lawyer team up situation we had in this. And
she's as foggy. She's as foggy.
Yeah, that's great.
She's foggy if Daredevil was like boning foggy. You know what I'm talking about?
You know, there's nothing wrong with that.
Do you think Daredevil has ever walked in on foggy completely naked in front of a fire? Like doing the.
Definitely. Don't you think so, Pete? Did you not hear Alex's question?
He asked you. I heard it.
And then I bet when Matt said, like, oh, no, the Daredevil has gotten my partner. Boy.
Anyway, yeah. Greg Pak's an amazing writer. This is just fantastic stuff. I'm a big fan of Shang-Chi, so this was glorious in a lot of ways.
I feel like Greg Pak should write a Shang-Chi series. This feels like it's jamming a bunch of stuff. Like, this story is ostensibly about the gang war, but we get a bunch of like relationship stuff that feels like it just feels a little overstuffed when I want this to be an ongoing where we're doing that stuff and then touching on the gang war rather than just cramming it all in because there's only one issue left of this. Like, I don't think we're going to follow up on his relationship.
We might.
Ongoing. Maybe, but like it just feels like there's ongoing story elements in a limited series that I wish was an ongoing series.
Yeah. I do like his girlfriend's shocked face, the way Kayo Majada
did. Great eyeballs.
Very funny. Trinity Special, number 1 from DC Comics, written by Tom King, art by Daniel Sempere and Belen Ortega. This is a collection of the backup stories about Trinity and the Super Sons that have run through a bunch of books. I think there's a couple of extra pages from Daniel Sempere, but maybe I'm imagining them. I'm not 100% sure. Whatever it is, if you miss that stuff, you could check it out here. I thought there was going to be a whole new story in this, but I don't think there is.
It's a nice package, though. I really liked especially the first two, the babysitting flip-flop, where we get to see Damian babysitting a younger Trinity, and then Superman and Damian, I guess, technically, messing up when they're supposed to be sort of paying attention to Trinity. Those are very fun. The art's fantastic. We have read these before, but this feels like if you want to really see the whole Trinity character as a whole, this lays it all out.
Yeah, this is great. I really think it's adorable in all the right ways and touching in all the right ways. I thought the jump kick was really fun, and the kind of like, how do you control somebody who is a badass superhero? So yeah, I just think it's a fun problems to have and really artistically well executed.
Yeah. Last but not least, Duke number 2 from Image Comics, written by Joshua Williamson. Once again, art by Tom Riley. Duke is on the run after discovering the Transformers, and he's being chased down by a bunch of members of, I don't think we've said G.I. Joe out loud, but a bunch of members of G.I. Joe, leading to...
Oh, they're Joes.
Oh, Yo-Joes. A surprise character, of course, at the end of the issue, who shows up to potentially team up with Duke. Pete, you seem jazzed.
Character we all knew the name of is... Yeah. We saw them.
Right? Did you guys know?
We all knew. That's what I'm saying. We all knew.
We'll count at three and we'll all say what it is.
No, that would be spoiling. We can't do that. We could never just say that. That would be crazy.
Yeah, or do we want to give a little spoiler, space and then
We could wait 7 seconds for one or more of us to Google it before we say it though.
Yeah, it was the spoilers, it was Baroness, and it was really well done, and I really loved it.
The Baroness.
Okay. Yeah. So she's like,
I'm the only G.I. Joe head.
She's
in this
royalty,
bunch.
Right? Like she's royalty, like that's her power. Like she has the power of a lady baron.
She's like a Meghan Markle.
Wow, you guys are really
Meghan Markle's a princess.
Yeah,
so she's like below. It's like she works for Meghan Markle.
Oh my god,
she's like her assistant on Suits.
This is just. I thought it was just.
I'm sorry. Was this character at the end? Was she on Suits?
That's a great question.
If so, which season?
I just thought that, like, I loved all the action. I loved the reveal at the end. I'm really enjoying this. Love the rock and roll shout out here. So I'm having a great time. More, please. I'm eating this up. This is just a ton of fun.
Let me ask you, this is a hypothetical, Pete, so this isn't real, but hypothetically, if I read this, that last panel is like, that's Lady J. Am I a bad person for thinking that hypothetically?
No, you're not a bad person. You just got some characters confused. That happens all the time.
What if, hypothetically, what if I read this issue and I got to the last page and I saw the lady there and I was like, that's Baroness. And my next thought was like, I don't know what that means, though.
Well, again, all hypotheticals.
It means that, we've got people locked up that are on both sides. So you got Cobras and Joes kind of next to each other. So it'll be interesting to see.
So she works for Cobra?
Yeah.
Like, does she work for... So I'm a little confused about the power structure in Cobra. So there's Cobra Commander, and there's Destro, and there's Baroness. Yeah. Who's in charge? Because Destro in this issue, I think... But Destro's the one on the throne, and there's Flames behind him, right? Who's like tapping his... fingers a little bit this issue.
Well, yeah, Destro's next in charge, but he shares the responsibility with Baroness, you know. But Cobra Commander doesn't like to listen to people's
like
ideas.
It's like more of like a democracy.
No, it's a
dictatorship. They all share power. So who's the dictator then?
Cobra Commander.
Okay, but he seems to be just like a scientist who's working there right now over in his series.
Sorry, was that Evil Lynn who's in the jail cell at the end from He-Man?
That wasn't Evil Lynn's catchphrase, so I don't think so.
She said her catchphrase, Baroness? What did she say at the end of the issue?
What's Evil Lynn's catchphrase? I'm in jail.
I'm Evil Lynn. That's what she says all the time.
That's her catchphrase, is her name?
I have a follow-up question. Evil.
People like this?
Yes.
Let me say, I wish Baroness' catchphrase was, I'm Baroness, the reveal at the end of this issue.
Well, you're not a big enough fan.
I really like this comic, actually, despite everything that we're saying here. Particularly Tom Riley's art is great. The character designs are great. I did miss a little bit of the conspiracy thriller feel of the first issue here because it was just pretty much straight action. But Tom Riley draws great action, so it's all good with me.
I agree. I really like this. I didn't miss the conspiracy. I'm hoping we're going to get back to that. This felt like everyone was calling out Duke for buying into that conspiracy theory, and then it was sort of proven true by what happened. This felt like, hey, they're just buddies having fun. Joe's even connecting and getting back together. Because he got to hang out with Junk Pile and then...
Junk Pile, you fucking asshole, man.
And then Gun showed up. Just let me know if I'm getting these names right or wrong.
You're not.
Okay.
Gun.
If you'd like to support this podcast and all the podcasts we do, patreon.com/comic.
If you like pina coladas.
Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. Please come out. We would love to chat with you about comic books. Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice to subscribe, listen, and follow the show, but not Google Podcasts, which is going away at the end of March. Please, if you subscribe there, subscribe literally any other platform. At Comic Book Live on Twitter/X, Comic Book Club Live on TikTok and Instagram, comicbookclublive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
Woo-hoo. So wait, there's a duke and a baroness? Is this like a royal family thing?
Oh my god. That blows your mind with that comic sense.